sound.
So do you like Austin though?
I love Austin.
Being in the sun?
I can't do the heat. I grew up in Dallas for 30 years.
Oh,
and
really?
And then I went to school down in San Marcos.
Oh, okay.
So I spent a lot of time in Austin. I also have some family. So it is definitely my favorite city in Texas. but not in July.
Yeah. Yeah, that is probably the unfortunate part about RTX every time. All right. So let's talk about RTX's PAX South. Because I'm inclined to agree with you.
Yeah.
But I feel like you've put much more thought into this.
I have put a lot of thought into it because one of the challenges that Robert Koo has with Penny Arcade and PAX in particular is that demand has far outstripped supply, right? Mm-hmm. The city of Seattle can only hold so many people. The city of Boston can only hold so many people. Their infrastructures just aren't necessarily set up for the number of sheer people who want to come to PAX. And so when I start to see events that are PAX-like, and to be clear, RTX is different than PAX. It's still very focused on the Rooster Teeth community. It's still very focused on Halo. But I see that it's changing a little bit. It's growing. There's a lot of indie games downstairs. There's a lot of independent hardware developers downstairs. Oculus Rift is here. I mean, there's all sorts of branching out that I see going on. There's artists, webcomic artists. So it is morphing into, for lack of a better way to put it, PAX South.
Mm-hmm.
And I love being amongst my tribe. So anytime my tribe can get together in great numbers, I want to be there for that.
Yeah.
And so I'm excited to see just how much it's growing and stretching while still retaining its focus on the community.
Yeah. And so, I mean, what was your first PAX that you went to?
2007, I think. That would be PAX Prime because PAX East hadn't opened yet.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been a gamer all my life. I can't remember why I couldn't go before. Oh, I remember now. It was always Labor Day weekend. And that was when one of my favorite bands, the Dave Matthews Band, plays the Gorge.
Uh-huh.
And the Columbia River Gorge is about 3 hours outside of Seattle. It is this gorgeous amphitheater that's cut into a bluff overlooking the desert. I don't know if you know, but Eastern Washington is mostly desert.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a glorious place to see a show. I mean, I've seen so many amazing bands there.
Yeah.
But he does four nights.
Oh, wow.
So it's a huge, like, a festival thing. And all my friends would, like, pack up our gear and go out and camp and just have fun. So, but now I go to PAX every year. Just because, again, it's my first time I went, I'm like, oh, man, I should have been doing this the whole time.
Yeah.
As much fun as I was having at those concerts, the community and the group of people, again, being amongst my tribe,
mm-hmm.
and getting to see all my friends who come into town to present or to do things on the exhibition floor is just super, super awesome. So, yeah. My first one was 2007.
Yeah, and I've only been to the past three. Well, I guess this one would be my third one. And in that short time, PAX has already changed so much. It's like, what do you feel that RTX has from an early PAX, even such as 2007?
That's a great question because there's three distinct answers to it. The first is that PAX Prime is now coming up on its close to its 10th year. I think it's this one will be the 9th.
Mm-hmm.
And Seattle is used to it. You know, this amazing thing sprung up out of nowhere. There was crazy energy. There was unbelievable. I can't believe such a thing exists. And now it's a little bit more laid back. It's a little bit more chill. And I discovered that when I went to PAX East, the very first PAX East, and I saw this crazy energy. Like, people were like, I can't believe this. You know, they were really, really excited.
Yeah.
And that's what I see here.
Yeah.
Is that excitement about this thing coming together and, oh, my God, I can't believe there are amazing people here. And I can't believe there are amazing things to do. And plus, look at the crazy growth. I mean, I think it was half this size last year, and they still sold everything out. You know, so I think there's like 8,500 people here or something like that. So I like to see that energy. I think PAX is maturing a little.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a bad thing, by the way.
Right.
That's not a bad thing at all. If you've not been to a PAX, then it's still amazing and you want to do it. But I think it is more of a set thing.
Mm-hmm.
They've got it down.
Yeah.
You know, so.
But do you think that sense of maturing also means it's appealing to a different set of people? Because I feel like press coverage has grown more for PAX Prime and such, whereas, like, it's not as much for PAX East and not as much for RTX. So do you think that's inherent to maturing?
Well, keep in mind that Robert and Jerry and Mike keep a very tight hold on on that. They don't like marketing, you know, on the show floor. They want that, you know, their rules are great. You know, like if you're coming to PAX and you want to market your game, it has to be playable. Mm-hmm. You have to let people play it. You can't just stand there and say, let me tell you, and here's a demo and this, that, and the other. It has to be something that people get to see. And I think that level of, I guess, integrity is the right word, or protecting the atmosphere. As long as you do that, I think it's fine. The press coverage, I think, is just more that in PAX you have 50, 60,000 gamers all in one place, plus every big company.
Yeah.
So I think that just naturally attracts press coverage.
Right. I'm not sure what the numbers compare for like PAX East to PAX Prime, but I feel like it definitely is a smaller affair.
East is bigger.
Oh, really?
East is bigger by about, Robert would have the numbers, but East is bigger than, like, I want to say 10,000, because Boston can simply hold more.
Right.
Than Seattle can. The problem with Seattle is its infrastructure downtown starts to break down right at about 50,000 people, and PAX brings in about 57 to 60.
Oh, yeah.
And that just plays havoc with the traffic. It plays havoc with the restaurants. It plays havoc with the hotels.
Right.
It plays havoc with the convention center, because it's not a very well laid out convention center.
Yeah.
East is a little bit better. It has it intentionally set aside convention center, and it's really, really large, and it's laid out really well.
Yeah.
So it's bigger.
Okay, well,
surprise.
Redacted.
No, I think it's super fascinating, because here's another thing that Robert talked about. I've done interviews with Robert on stage at PAX, mm-hmm. where just he and I in a couple of chairs, and we just share and I ask him questions.
Right. And those are always great.
Yeah, they're fun. And what he shared the last time when we were talking about the challenges of PAX Prime and conventions in general, he shared that one of the problems that they have that they're trying to figure out how to deal with, and maybe they won't have to deal with it per se, but is crossover. Mm-hmm. It's like people who go to PAX Prime also go to PAX East, so PAX East isn't actually alleviating any pressure on the infrastructures and on the attendance and the fact that they sell out in 4 hours. So I think something like RTX has the opportunity to gradually mm-hmm. become something different. I mean, I don't want to say that it's PAX South, but if I had to describe it quickly, I would probably say, have you been to PAX? It's a lot like a PAX.
No, it definitely feels a bit different. There's definitely more skew towards YouTubers.
Yeah,
and content
creation. Totally. Content. Yes, it's definitely geared towards the creative types out there, but also the fans of those creative types. And mm-hmm. I think that's what's so exciting.
Yeah, they're definitely a different type of fan.
Yeah.
Like, they're the same people that would be at VidCon, and those are just nuts.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree.
Yeah. But let's talk about what you used to do, being a lot about behind the scenes. How do you feel like that would be improving or changing, maybe even being worse in the next generation?
I think, being sort of the enforcement and safety person for the online service for Xbox Live, mm-hmm. Back then I think there were a lot of constraints and limitations on the system itself. It was designed in 2004, 2005. It organically grew over time to add all these features and amazing things.
Right.
What they're doing with Xbox One and the new Xbox Live is fantastic. They are actually taking a lot of steps that Major Nelson just did a blog post on this. They've got a new reputation system that's coming that's going to be far more effective than has ever been before. There will be a concerted effort to optimize people's experiences to be positive.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, they want to have new players be matched with players who have a high reputation. And players who have a bad reputation will only be matched with players who also have a bad reputation. So jerks will play with jerks, and the new people will play with good people.
Yeah.
And so I think that it's going to get better is the shortest way to put it.
Yeah. But there's a sense of things perhaps changing and not knowing if it's for better or worse, mm-hmm. especially considering perhaps a growing influence from the consumers, such as the pressure to change about Microsoft's DRM, always online stuff, and being all digital, like changing how you consider ownership of all digital versus physical. What sort of changes do you see happening there?
I think it's fascinating that consoles are the last holdout.
Mm-hmm.
We have already adopted this model with our DVRs. We have already adopted this model with our phones and our tablets. We've already adopted this model with Steam on the PC. So this idea that I license the rights to digital bits, we've already, like, everybody thought the world was going to end when Half-Life 2 shipped with Steam, and you had to install Steam before you could activate Half-Life 2. And there's certainly been missteps. I mean, Diablo 3 had a rough launch. SimCity had a rough launch. But there's been so many successes that over time, people don't even blink about Steam. And the reason they don't blink about Steam is because they have these amazing sales. And you get a real value out of trading your ability to sell these games or resell these games, because after a year or two of a game being out, then it's suddenly like you can get a bundle for $4.99 of four games that would have cost you $120 12 months ago. Mm-hmm. So people are very forgiving of that. If we move to the App Store, like the Apple App Store, you've got 99-cent games all over the place. And sometimes they do these things where the game's free for 24 hours, and you get to keep it, you know. And so we've given up on that platform the thought that, oh, I need to be able to resell. So it's interesting to me that consoles are the place where people are planting their flag and saying, this far, no further.
Yeah.
It's inevitable. It's inevitable. What will end up happening, I can almost guarantee it, is that once that model is palatable to the console owner, and it'll be quick, it'll probably be in 24 months inside of the life cycle, you'll start to see that physical discs are no longer the thing you own. Instead, the physical disc is what saved you 4 hours of download time for a 50 gigabyte game, right? And I think people will move to that model pretty naturally, as long as, I got a soundtrack now. I think as long as then the platform owners like Sony and Microsoft and Nintendo see that Steam example of success and that Apple level of success and say, okay, we're no longer going to do used games, right? That's going to be, we may let you gift one or something like that, but publishers do need to get paid on the other side of that model. What we'll trade you is, you know, 12 months, 24 months, whatever, when a game ages out a little bit, these amazing sales. And, yeah. And the great thing about, like, the latest sort of, everybody loves good graphics, everybody loves great sound, but this generation is not going to be a massive leap like the last generation was. If you go from Xbox One to 360, or you go to PS2 to PS3, you're moving to high def.
Right.
So that's a big, and 5.1 sound, so you're, that's a big leap. There's not an equivalent leap here. What you're going to get in this console generation are better textures, better anti-aliasing, more complex environments, but you're really not getting a tremendous amount of pixels.
Right.
And so I think that combined with some other things are going to make people a little bit more okay with the change in DRM. There will always be people who will plant the flag, but the reality is that technology is moving on.
Yeah. Well, what do you think about that that balance between appeasing the consumer and pushing forward innovation?
It's super tough for me.
Yeah.
Because as a gamer, I want to live in a world where there are used games. Mm-hmm. I want to live in that world. I want that world to continue to exist. The world has moved on, or is moving on. And I have to, I mean, I can either sit and rage about it or, you know, and I know that sounds like me saying deal with it. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying, please understand, there's a part of my brain that doesn't ever want that to go away. But Blockbuster's gone. You know, who knows how much longer places like Best Buy have? The world is changing to a much more connected model. And I think people are just very leery, understandably so, of giving up a lot of those rights that they have enjoyed with previous things.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody buys CDs anymore.
Nope.
Right? I mean, physical discs, like, I know I have friends who have kids in the 8 to 12-year-old range. And they think getting up to put a disc in the tray is like the most old-fashioned, quaint thing in the world. Because they've grown up with their iPod in their hand, and they punch a button and get the parents' permission, and bam, their app is there. And so there's more of those kids are going to be driving the money than me, the 40-year-old guy who says, nah, I want my used games, right?
Yeah.
And that's just reality, and you have to, as you age, you just kind of have to kind of accept it.
Yeah.
You know, it's very get off my lawn, you know? And you gotta just kind of roll with it.
Yeah. Just sitting near a lawn chair on your porch, throwing CDs out there.
Pretty much.
You kids,
you have no idea.
So do you think it's more about just like waiting for?
Over that shit.
Yeah.
I birdie.
So do you think it's more about the people who are planting those flags aging out, and like the numbers moving towards their favor?
They're going to always be a smaller population with the younger generation coming up. I'm a part of that, right? I mean, so it's tough for me to see, but these kids, you want to grab them and you want to say, you don't know what you're giving up. But the reality is they don't care.
Yeah.
And I have a great example of this. I wrote a book called A Microsoft Life, which was about my time at Microsoft.
Mm-hmm.
And when I released it, I first released it digitally. DRM-free PDF. And it sold okay, you know, it wasn't bad. And I kept getting people clamoring for Kindle, which has a minimum level of DRM. I mean, period.
Yeah.
And so I resisted that because I didn't want there to be any DRM anywhere. And finally, I released it on Kindle, and I announced that I released it on Kindle, and I sold 10 times as many copies on Kindle than the free, than the DRM-free PDF. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, people are willing to trade a little bit of their rights for convenience, and that audience on Kindle has made that switch, right? Consoles, people are just planning, they haven't made the switch yet, and they tend to be super vocal.
Yeah.
I mean, I guarantee you 73 million Xbox 360 users aren't mad about DRM. A very vocal group who are super important, hardcore gamers, that's an incredibly important audience, are vocal about it, and they I think they did a great job enforcing change. So it'll be interesting to see where it goes from here.
So what do you think are like viable next steps to make that happen, not just like waiting?
It is inevitable that consoles will move to digital distribution models. Mm-hmm. And I think the step is convincing people or making them understand two things. Internet is going to become more and more dial tone, what we call dial tone in the industry, meaning that you can always trust that it's going to be there. You pick up the phone, you always hear a dial tone.
Mm-hmm.
Internet is going to become much more dial tone over the next 5 to 10 years. That's the first thing. So your lack of connection will start to no longer be the reason that you can really object. It's gonna permeate airplanes. It's gonna permeate all these places that people are worried about. Like, I want to be able to play my single player game without having to do this. I think publishers will also take a step back and not be so draconian, and maybe they'll say a week, mm-hmm. you know, whatever, of no internet, then we're going to say, you may have, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And the second thing is really around that, making people understand that the physical media is a time saver, not a thing you own. And when you get to that, like, that point, as long as the publishers and the platform owners are agreeable on the terms of you can give the game to one person, you can play it on another console. I'm actually sad to see some of the features launched for Xbox One had to go away because they took the online. I mean, I liked the
family stuff.
The family stuff was great. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I mean, you have to let that go if you can't at least validate it. And in my old role, one of my things is anti-piracy. And you wouldn't believe just how many people will say, you know, to a friend, here's my password, and enjoy all my content, you know, and people do that all the time, and it's tough. It's, you know, you got to balance the people who are the legitimate customers versus the people who want to break the rules. That's a really tough balance.
Yeah, and you see those sorts of technologies and methodologies improving in the next generation of, like, monitoring that sort of stuff?
Let's hope so, right? I mean, you can't have false positives, and you can't have launch day failures. You just can't. I mean, I think had SimCity and Diablo 3 not gone the way they did, I don't think people would be as frustrated. Steam has actually done a pretty good job of fixing that stuff. And I think people are more comfortable with that. I mean, people trust Steam. You know, they look at Steam and they say, Valve is not evil for that.
Yeah.
I think Sony and Microsoft and Nintendo have to get there. They're not there yet. So yes, it does have to improve. Mm-hmm. It has to be at least as good as Steam.
Mm-hmm. I think the problem, part of that is, though, that Valve kind of solved a lot of that through sheer brute force and just, like, finding their way through the maze of, like, what works.
Yeah.
And lots of consumers are expecting that almost immediately, whereas most of these companies, such as Nintendo and Sony, don't have that experience.
Yeah, people don't remember how bad Steam was. There were gamers just saying, I'll never buy another Valve game, and I'll never buy anything off of Steam. And people just forget that stuff. They just forget it. And it's so funny to me because people just have very, very short memories when it comes down to their outrage.
Mm-hmm.
When you can provide them with something that is really super compelling, like a great game that's like Half-Life 2, an amazing experience that you're going to complain about it, but you're going to, in Diablo 3 or these other games, yes, you're going to be, and you should be angry about, you know, when launch day failures happen and they don't support you. But I thought EA did a great job with SimCity, turning around and giving away games and giving you credits and giving you stuff, like, you know, to make up for it. I think as long as publishers do that, people are willing to forget.
Yeah. I mean, Sony is a pretty good example from just,
like, everyone's kind of forgotten that whole network down for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Right? That wasn't even your internet was down.
No.
They took down the whole network.
Yeah.
Um,
I guess what are you most excited about for game-wise coming out?
Well, I'm actually really looking forward to getting home and being able to play The Last of Us.
Oh, yeah?
Because I haven't played it yet. And all my friends are, like, they're really funny because they don't want to spoil it. So
yeah.
Like, have you played it yet? And I'm like, no. And they get frustrated because they're like, well, then I can't talk to
you. You get really careful about clicking stuff.
Yeah. I'm super excited about the new Walking Dead expansion. Coming up in the future, so the stuff that I saw coming out of E3, I'm blown away by Titanfall.
Oh.
I am just blown away by it. And it... they did, I can say this now that E3 is over, I'm sure they'll do it again, but the demo that they gave, we're sitting in there, and when you're in E3 and doing a demo, it's usually two guys in the back of the room, they're playing through a level while one guy is walking you through, like telling you what's going on the screen, and you're in a theater full of people, it's like maybe 20 people, and you're all watching this big screen, it's very loud.
Mm-hmm.
And they were telling us all this stuff, and they were running around the level, but this is something that was very odd, because they kept dying. They kept getting killed.
Yeah.
But that never happens. Like, demos are always perfect.
Yeah.
Like, demos are always, like, they've rehearsed it for 700 hours for 4 weeks beforehand, and they're not going to screw it up because they want the game to look the best. In the middle of the demo, they swept a curtain back, and it revealed that it was a room beside us filled with real people playing against them. So they were being played against by, so the whole thing was not staged at all. And it was one of the best demos I've ever seen because they were willing to show that and not tell you.
Yeah.
And then they swept the reveal and said, you're not just watching what we hope the multiplayer will be. You are watching what it is.
Yeah.
And that was amazing. So yeah. Titanfall is amazing. I'm looking forward to Destiny quite a bit. Mario Kart 8 looks great on the Wii U. Trying to think what else I saw. I think that's probably the most. Fantasia. Actually gave that my game of the event because, I mean, that blew me away. It is, if anyone's ever played Child of Eden, it's a lot like a more, even more amazing and a little bit easier version of Child of Eden. And it's gorgeous. It's just absolutely stunning.
Yeah, it's also not what you would expect just watching the trailer.
Yeah. That trailer's awful.
Yeah.
That is the worst trailer ever. Yes.
Yeah.
It is an awful trailer. Don't go by the trailer. Just wait for some more gameplay stuff to come out. When you watch someone play it who plays it well, it is almost beautiful.
Yeah.
To watch the person play it. So.
Watching someone play it for the first time, I felt the same way when I first saw someone play Guitar Hero. I was like, let me try that real quick.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's how you feel. It's very, very, it's a very good game.
Yeah. I don't know, I think that's about it for it. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah,
thank
no
you
problem.
Very much. It's great
that's
meeting
perfect
you, too.
Perfect amount of time. Yeah.